This is Future of Water, where we talk about all the ways in which companies, utilities, and people are addressing challenges and opportunities in water. So this is Reese Tisdale again. We're going to try something a little bit different today. I think at the request of some listeners, shout out to all those who made some suggestions, external and internal. We're going to change format a little bit in that, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about news up front. So because our team is always scanning the news wire, we hope to touch upon some relevant news items and events that we think about every week. So we thought we'd share those with you. Some of these are delivered through Bluefield's weekly newsletter, Waterline. So you can always go out and sign up for that. But let's give it a shot. And from there, we'll go into our regularly scheduled discussion with Bluefield's team of analysts. Today, it's going to be Cullen Mitchell, where we talk about water for power. So what happened this past week? At least a couple of news items that I thought were interesting and those were shared with me. So in the wake of COVID, energy market downturns that we've seen and talked about on this podcast, one thing of note, Aegon Corporation is intending to divest its energy services segment, right, in planning to reduce its oil and gas exposure. And it's now going to place greater focus or even sole focus on water and wastewater pipeline rehabilitation technologies. This is interesting because we recently put out a trenchless pipe report or solutions report looking at a number of players. Aegon obviously plays a big deal or role in that market with its in-situ rehabilitation services in its business unit. So according to the aforementioned headwinds, when we're talking about a downturn in oil and gas, this is something that we're seeing not only among Aegon, but a number of companies, as discussed in our top companies and water analysis, we're putting out quarterly looking at the financials of publicly traded companies. COVID and related energy markets have driven a pivot of sorts, forcing companies to rethink their strategies. For industrial companies, ongoing volatility and disruption in some segments like this has impacted, obviously, Aegon, Evoqua, and others to dedicate really resources towards pharma, data centers, food and bev, where they think there's going to be potentially less volatility, more focus on sustainability. Keep in mind, the energy sector, this is the second time in as many as 5 years, I believe, that there's been a steep decline. And it looks like this one's really going to hurt because the market was actually softening even prior to COVID and sort of the global glut of supply, which started in March at the same time as sort of the initial quarantining in the Northeast in the US, as well as globally, places like Italy. Second point of news that I thought was interesting, new desalination plant in Antwerp is planned to be built by 2024. It's going to pump up brackish dock water and convert it into water for the chemical sector in the area. Chemical companies located in the city's port, Covestra and Evonik, have already signed on as off-takers. Who cares, right? Well, actually, a number of considerations are being made, including the fact that these industrial companies are no longer going to rely on drinking water from the, I think it's the Albert Canal for industrial production processes. Drinking water for industrial uses seems kind of ridiculous. It's treated to a higher level than need be. Quite honestly, it sounds like, you know, in this case, drinking water use for these companies is going to decline by as much as 98%. You know, it's a better way of utilizing resources. It also takes stress off the municipal water utility who's providing the basic residential and commercial services. Industrials are increasingly being more creative. You know, we often look at the Middle East for desalination opportunities, but this one rings a little bit differently. It's in Europe, in Antwerp of all places, and it's also designated for industrial purposes. We anticipate to see more deals like this. The other aspect of this, which I think is interesting, that it's Avayo and AECOM. They're going to lead the project development, construction, and operations. Avayo is actually an infrastructure fund that was spun out of AECOM a couple of years ago. And I think last year it reportedly raised about $1 billion from investors. So I think 2/3 of the funds from Avayo are going to be dedicated or allocated to U.S. projects and opportunities. And what's interesting is that in its partnership or relationship with AECOM, which I think is where a number of the management team came from in some cases, AECOM is kind of the spearhead. They're going to help identify projects for financing opportunities. So two interesting topics, a little bit scattered around the world, obviously, but nonetheless interesting. So there you have it. Those are a couple takeaways of the week. I can recommend Waterline. Every week we send it out to registrants to our website, bluefieldresearch.com. You can always go there and you'll get definitely a couple news items. We also give away complimentary research and give people the heads up, not only about the Future Water podcast, which you're listening to now, but also Dave McGimsey's Water Values podcast. Shout out to Dave. He just put out his year-end review. I thought it was a really interesting discussion. Had a really interesting tone and message for what's happening in the water sector related to COVID. And just some interesting insights, like upside, downside, and also some interesting takeaways and lessons learned from the last recession. You know, those that were actually proactive subsequent to the last recession, those that prepared, made investment in training, technology, and also rate structures are actually better off today. That's an initial take. So definitely Water Values podcast, definitely worth a listen. So with that being said, let's get Cullen Mitchell in here and see what he has to say about the power landscape. All right, guys, I'm joined today by my colleague, Cullen Mitchell. Cullen's an analyst for Bluefield's Industrial Water Insight Service. He joined the team earlier this fall, but that's actually after a stint of working with us during his graduate school time in Boston. So Cullen, first time Future Water, first time podcast?
Yeah. Hey, Reese, how's it going? Thanks for having me. First time on a podcast ever.
Nice. All right. Well, let's do this. So this will be good. So the reason we're on here is the discussion, we talked about this a little bit last week as we were going through topics and considering like what's interesting. And you put out some research on water for power recently. So let's just start with the basics. So what was the recent analysis about, or why are we talking about it?
Yeah. So I think it kind of started with noticing some shifts in the market across different sectors of the economy that seemed to be signaling that hydrogen was something that businesses were looking at. Hyundai, the automaker, is making a commitment to produce hundreds of thousands of hydrogen-powered vehicles over the next 10 years. We're seeing a lot of utilities in California and Florida, for example, that have a lot of expertise currently in renewables and other more traditional forms of power, looking to hydrogen as a potential business opportunity. And then this is no secret to most people, I think, that the energy market in general isn't doing so hot right now. The price of oil back in August was $39, which is 30% lower than where it was in January even, which wasn't great either. Overall, fossil fuel sales are down year over year, 34%. And just a little recent history context, in September 2013, the price of oil was $102. So that really just shows you how far it's come. A lot of companies are seeing the writing on the wall, so to speak, at least in the short term. You mentioned Aegon earlier selling off their energy services business, really trying to reduce their exposure to oil and gas. And then lastly, I think we're really interested in, from a policy perspective, what a new incoming administration to the White House means for power. President-elect Biden has been pretty vocal about a net zero target for 2050 in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. And he specifically mentioned green hydrogen, renewable hydrogen power as a tool that he wants to use to achieve that goal. So I think that really signals some big shifts in power.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to unpack. And I think we discussed this. There's a bit of a triad of players involved. You've got automobile manufacturers, like you mentioned, Hyundai, they're working with Ineos. Then you've got the power sector. You know, you've got power utilities that are now looking at it, whether they be renewable developers or even just, you know, generating utilities in specific states in the US or Europe. And then lastly, you have petrochem, right? You have chemical companies, like I mentioned, Ineos. So there are these number of players, their activities are partly being shaped by really demand shifts, right? And so what's happening with demand, not only because of COVID, but just what's happened. There's been this transition in energy markets, but also policy directives, like you mentioned. So as we do, we talk about water. So what does this mean for water, and how much I mean, how much water does the water sector use, and where are we seeing shifts in this demand?
Yeah, so overall in the U.S., we use about 322 billion gallons of water a day, which is a lot. And thermoelectric power, coal, nuclear, natural gas, a big driver of that. Overall, 45% of all that water withdrawal is for thermoelectric power. We need that for cooling, even extraction, refining, and transport of that power. So it's really intrinsic to a lot of the processes for us to get power. But we're shifting more towards renewables, which would mean a whole lot less water. And so because of that, because renewables are becoming a bigger part of our power portfolio, water usage has gone down since 2010 by 9%. And efficiencies across the board in thermoelectric power are responsible for close to 90% of that reduction in those withdrawals. And even according to my analysis, from 2015 to 2020, water withdrawals for power went down by 25%. So using a lot of water, but it is trending down.
But behind that, so let's step back a little bit. I mean, there's the coal issue, right? Issue, if you want to call it. But basically, because of climate, aging plants, and really just pure economics, you know, other fuel types and fuel generation is cheaper than coal, right? Some of these coal plants are pretty old. So when they have to, it's either maintain and operate an aging coal fleet. Instead, you know, with the abundance over the last decade of natural gas, you know, particularly in places like the Marcellus, you're seeing a lot more natural gas plants, you know, in the U.S. in particular. So that's one shift that's happening. But also over the past decade and a half, harkening back to my days in the renewable energy sector, that, you know, what was costly as far as deployment of solar or wind is now incredibly competitive with even cheap coal, right? So that's happening as well. So there is this change towards, like you said, you know, new plants mean really more efficient plants at the end of the day. I mean, we've always said, you know, in discussing with our clients, when they look at the power sector, they come to us and say, well, where's the opportunity? And we're always telling them, you need to look for new build. Like the margins are often, particularly on the aging plants, their margins are so low, is it even worth it? And also their regulatory drivers. But if you have a new greenfield project going on, then that's the time to get in. So what you're saying is that the market opportunity for water solutions providers, companies we work with, are they shrinking?
Well, yes and no. I think reliance on fossil fuels is obviously trending down in the US and a lot of OECD countries in Western Europe. But I think natural gas, even with these countries that are making these ambitious climate goals, natural gas will still be an important source of power for these countries. And nuclear could be as well, which will still be pretty water intensive. But even globally, fossil fuels are still kind of on the rise. Investment in coal in Asia and Africa has actually been pretty robust over the past few years. But then, of course, this growth in hydrogen, I think, presents huge potential for water players.
Yeah, I think when it comes to the hydrogen piece, I mean, that could be a decade out. But let's talk a little bit about that, because I think it's really interesting. We've had questions come to us. We already talked a little bit about Hyundai. But so why don't you give us some examples of where we're seeing hydrogen developments happening?
Yeah. So I think Florida Power and Light is a really interesting one. They're a utility, obviously, in Florida, owned by NextEra, which has expertise in renewable energy. And they're currently building, so not even, you know, this is happening, you know, pretty close to right now. They're building a 20 megawatt electrolyzer to produce hydrogen. So harnessing that renewable energy expertise to produce more clean power.
If I might interrupt, I love this one. This is really interesting. Like I said, I used to work in the renewable energy space, and Florida Power and Light, who's owned by NextEra, they're also one of the largest renewable players in the US, if not the world. I think even Wall Street Journal had something last week about sort of the rise of these renewable, titans. I don't remember the exact word, but they were comparing them to the other fossil fuel companies. So the rise of companies like NextEra, Enel, Berkshire Hathaway is actually a huge renewable owner in the US. But NextEra is interesting because they got into wind early, really innovative in the way they approach the market as an independent power player in the US, which is where they're focused. And then they started getting into solar and they started trying things out, but they own Florida Power and Light in Florida, which is a utility, and they have used it as a source for pilot projects. Like I've been to their concentrating solar thermal plant in Florida, which at the time was innovative, really interesting. It didn't fully pan out. Solar PV, now they're a huge solar PV producer. Now its costs have come down. What's interesting about this, you mentioned it, there's hydrogen. And how do you produce hydrogen, which maybe you're going to get to, is they using electrolysis, but it's also green hydrogen. So not only do they have renewables, if there's more renewables on the grid or on the network, there may just be, quite honestly, too much. And there's always concerns about curtailment. So they may have excess capacity with the proliferation of wind and solar. Therefore, with that excess capacity, they got to do something with it, or could they do something with it? So why not have an electrolyzer nearby to run that plant or drive it? And then they can produce hydrogen at the same time. So sorry, don't mean to interrupt, but I'm really excited about this because I think they could be at the leading edge of all of this.
Yeah. So I think hydrogen presents this really good opportunity to kind of grow almost in tandem with renewables. Kind of the main, or one of the main critiques of renewables often, especially solar and wind, is the intermittency problem. So we can't turn on or turn off the sun or wind. But hydrogen, especially green hydrogen, which is what I think kind of the policy pushes for, would provide storage opportunity for all of this excess solar and wind power, which then could be used, you know, on a cloudy day or a not so windy day.
Yeah, I think that is... That's huge, right? In the sense that, you know, it's just hard to believe just over the past decade, we started looking at water for fracking in 2013, I believe, at Bluefield. I mean, we were young then, wet behind the ears, as I would say, and as a company. And the expectation was that natural gas was basically going to take over the world. Now, there are transport issues with natural gas, and it has grown dramatically, and there's an abundance of it. So it's not going away. But when it was placed alongside renewables, the argument was always, well, renewables need backup. And there's been this just transition. Evolution, it seems a little slow as far as words go to describe it. The transition from gas and then batteries have really built up, and that there's all these sort of on-site battery capabilities and also renewable portfolio targets, which require on-site battery storage. We're seeing that in Southern California Edison, actually some wastewater utilities, I think is Inland Empire, if I believe, or Irvine Ranch in California. They have on-site batteries at their wastewater facilities, and they have a power purchase agreement with Southern California Edison to meet state targets. That's a whole nother matter. Really interesting. We've done a little bit of research on that as an opportunity for utilities. But now if hydrogen is on the horizon, there are other uses for that, right? It could, power usage is one. And then obviously vehicles, right? We're seeing the move towards electric vehicles as well. So there's going to have to be power generation for that. And so I think your research note that you put out recently for clients was really about INEOS's partnership with Hyundai. And I think it was 700,000 fuel cell units by 2030. It was a target. INEOS is a chemical petrochem company in Europe. So it'll be interesting to see that as well. And then I think, did I recall, LADWP also has a plant maybe in Utah or Nevada as well?
Yeah. So California is also setting up something like 1,000 hydrogen refueling stations with the hope of being able to power 1 million hydrogen powered vehicles by 2030.
Yeah. I mean, let's be realistic. Is it still a long shot? I don't know. It feels like a long way out there, but things have changed so dramatically. Well, let's get back to the hydrogen created by, what is it, electrolysis or electrolyzers. What does that mean for water? Like, what are the issues there? Does it need a lot of water?
Yeah. So we've been kind of using that word electrolysis for a little bit. You can get hydrogen power from fossil fuels as well, but this kind of green hydrogen, which again is what's getting kind of the policy emphasis, I think, which driving that in the market, is made from water. And actually ultra pure water so that it doesn't degrade the electrolyzers, the machinery that generate the hydrogen. And it uses about 2.4 gallons of water per kilogram of hydrogen. And that process is basically using electricity. In the case of green hydrogen, it would be renewable, generate electricity to split these water molecules. To kind of take you back to middle school science, water is hydrogen and oxygen. And so splitting those up with electricity into the hydrogen and oxygen, which then you can use the hydrogen as fuel storage.
Okay, so basically you're going to need water supply. There's sort of the process of capturing or cracking the electrons and capturing those for power usage. And then there's a byproduct. I mean, there's water at the end, there's steam at the end of the line as well, correct?
Yeah, so the heat would be a byproduct and recapturing that water to be used again in that process.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. One, there's got to be a supply source. So that may ultimately be a constraining factor in some cases, depending on where you are geographically. But also there's the treatment if you have to get to ultra pure. I mean, as I've always said, there's no shortage of technologies or solutions that exist today for things like that. So that may be an opportunity. And then also on the backside, where is it discharged or how is that water managed? Is it reused for the same process? It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. So we'll continue talking to companies and firms in that market. So it feels like, I mean, I don't know, we're in the US. I don't know if we call ourselves climate deniers, more broadly speaking, but we seem to be somewhat in denial policy-wise. So I think in your analysis, you've started looking around, like what's happening in Europe? You know, they've embraced climate change and adoption of solutions. In fact, you know, even their infrastructure stimulus, we have some research coming out on this, you know, post-COVID is really focused on clean infrastructure build out or investments related to water, energy usage by water, wastewater utilities. So to make a long story short, Europe is where we look. So what should we be thinking about, I guess, policy-wise, even in the US with, you mentioned, you know, new president, what are we thinking there and where the change might be and what should we look for?
Yeah, so President-elect Biden has talked a lot about reinstating the Clean Power Plan, which was an effort during the end of the Obama administration to reduce emissions through how we make power. That program really left it up to individual states on how they would meet those targets. So I think we're probably going to see kind of regional variation, if you will, maybe state by state. Hydrogen might become really big in one part of the country or not take root in another part. So I think kind of there will be pushes more towards developing markets for more renewables and potentially hydrogen, but whether it has kind of national adoption, it remains to be seen. I will kind of reiterate again, I think hydrogen does have this potential to grow with renewables. It isn't necessarily an either or thing. So I think as renewable energy is adopted more in the US, we could see hydrogen really grow as well.
I mean, what's amazing is I saw something in the New York Times the other day. I think renewables, you know, this year, 2020, the crappiest year ever, will have grown 40% over prior year, over 2019, or solar specifically. I don't want to be more specific. That's incredible, right? And so that really is where the growth is. There are a lot of jobs tied to renewables and solar. I'll admit it. I'm a bit of a proponent. I've worked in the solar industry. I love oil and gas. I think it's interesting and exciting, but you know, I think this argument will continue to go on. I know even in the recent stimulus, there were discussions about, do we call it stimulus, crisis management, whatever the funds that came out of the federal government were of those trillions of dollars. I think even the White House had said none of this goes to solar and wind. Fine. That's neither here nor there now. But yeah, policy, your point, getting back to that, I think in the US, it's going to be state driven, without a doubt. That's how solar and wind built out, you know, places like California, even Pennsylvania with wind, which is actually a gas state because of the Marcellus. Texas, big wind state, you know, Arizona, Nevada, solar, among others. So those costs are down. So that's how it's going to happen. I think even California, you know, if they said, you know, no combustion engines after, I forgot what the date was. So once the targets like that start to be set, as much as people hate them, that could cause a real shift and also drive down prices, right? I think once it forces people to really, you know, look more closely at costs, not that they aren't already, that is where the change is going to be. So, all right. Well, this is Cullen. This is awesome. So let's just, let's wrap it up. And, you know, I want to thank you for talking about this, but how about plug any research you're working on now, what's happening otherwise?
Yeah. So right now I'm doing some research on water demand, the pulp and paper industry, kind of looking at how consumer preferences and changes in spending and even larger macroeconomic trends are causing shifts in that market.
Yeah, I think we internally, we talk about like the Amazon effect. What happens when, you know, everything in my house that's brought into my house now feels like it's coming from Amazon? Or as I'd mentioned someone the other day, the great toilet paper scare early in COVID, you know, what is it? That's all that comes from pulp and paper industry. So it'll be interesting to learn more about that over the coming week. So Cullen, thanks again. I appreciate your stepping up. I know you're in Dallas right now on your fancy 5G network. Who knew? I don't think we have that in Boston, but you're missing out on a fun bomb cyclone right now. So thanks again for stepping up and be well.
Yeah, thanks for having me. You too.
All right, take it easy. All right, guys, before we sign off, please subscribe to The Future Water. Give a review, 5 stars. That's all we want. Give us a 5-star review and send us a note at waterexperts@bluefieldresearch.com with any topic ideas you would like us to discuss. We're doing this for you. It's not like we like sitting around in our closets talking about water. Well, we might, but we'd like to do it for you as well. So also tell a friend about it. This podcast and these water industry insights have been brought to you by Bluefield Research. To learn more about us, bluefieldresearch.com. Happy holidays. Talk soon.